from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Now that the Republican National Convention has wrapped up, all eyes turn this week to Charlotte, North Carolina, where the Democratic National Convention officially convenes today. Former President Bill Clinton will give the nominating address to President Obama on the last night of the convention, which will also feature speeches by First Lady Michelle Obama and former Republican Governor of Florida Charlie Crist. We survey what lies ahead for the DNC in the opening hour of Forum, beginning after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. This opening hour of Forum, we turn our attention to the Democratic National Convention, which convenes today in Charlotte, North Carolina, and runs through Thursday as the nation continues to prepare for the November 6th election, which will determine who the next president of the United States will be. In this hour, we preview the convention and focus on what is at stake. And joining us from Charlotte, North Carolina, is Robin Avkarian, who is national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Robin, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning to you. I guess one of the questions looming in people's minds, maybe you can answer for us, is why North Carolina, in light of the fact that it's a right-to-work state and a state that is not in favor of same-sex marriage?
Yeah, there's been a lot of controversy about why the Democrats chose North Carolina, but I think if it comes down to one thing and one thing only, it is that this is a swing state, and you want every advantage that you can get. Charlotte is a very interesting city that's been through many iterations in the last 50, 60 years. It's a booming bank town. It's got an amazing new skyline. So there's a lot of economic growth and interesting stuff happening here. There are a lot of very disaffected Democrats, though, about why the DNC chose to convene here. And you've been hearing a lot of that from unions who are, you know, both trying to keep a good face on things, but also make their disappointment known with the DNC for choosing a right-to-work state.
Well, the RNC got a bump from their convention, very small one.
Small.
We've got a running of about 45% each for the two major candidates. And by candidates, of course, I mean along with their running mates. What do you anticipate the Democrats are going to do in this convention to convince American public or American citizens that the answer to that question that President Reagan posed in 1980 is on the Democratic side of the ledger, that is, that Americans are somehow better off than they were,
you know,
4 years ago?
Such an interesting question, because suddenly that question has become a theme almost of the week. And I think Democrats were a little bit ham-handed when they first were asked the question, but now they've come kind of roaring back. I was just at a meeting this morning of the California delegation, and Senator Barbara Boxer was a speaker, and she went through a whole call and response thing with the crowd on, are you better off, you know, now that we have Don't Ask, Don't Tell, now that we have the Lilly Ledbetter Act for fair pay for women, now that we have universal health care, now that women can get contraception coverage in their insurance. And the crowd was very enthusiastic, yelling, yes, we are better off. Of course, you know, there's an equally vociferous other side saying, no, we're not. So I think what we're going to be seeing in the convention is an attempt to reach out to people in very emotional and strong terms, clarifying the differences between the two tickets, but also making very overt appeals to women, to Hispanics, to the people who loved Bill Clinton despite his foibles, because, of course, he's one of the main speakers. Joe Biden will be appealing to the middle-class, blue-collar type. So what the convention is all about is persuading that last little slice of undecideds that the Democrats have your best interest at heart and the Republicans don't.
Well, mobilizing the base essentially I guess what you're hearing is the buzz, a lot of harsh rhetoric against the Romney-Ryan ticket.
Yeah, you know what? I had a very interesting conversation with Sandra Fluck, the young woman who Rush Limbaugh called a very unsavory name, as you may remember, when Congress was dealing with requiring insurers to provide contraception in their plans. She will be a speaker on Wednesday night, and she told me that she was asked to really hammer specifics on policy differences between the Romney-Ryan ticket and the Obama-Biden ticket. So even at that level, you know, they're going to be asking somebody like her to be very specific, and I think you'll be seeing a lot of harsh rhetoric from other speakers about how Romney and Ryan are bad for you and want nothing more than to bring back the Bush administration. It's going to be, I think, not quite as soft and fuzzy as you might have expected.
We're talking to Robin Upkarian, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina, and who is national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Just how much talk is there going to be about hope and change, do you think?
You know what? It's so interesting because now that there's a record that the Obama administration has compiled in the last 3.5 years, it's not as powerful a message. And I don't know that it's even necessary to hearken back to that moment. Sure, there will be attempts to sort of revive the enthusiasm that greeted President Obama in 2008. But, you know, he was an empty vessel in some ways at that time, you know, allowing people to project their hopes and dreams onto him. Now there's a record. Now there's something really to talk about. And I think they have to deal more with the specifics of how a second Obama administration would differ from a Romney-Ryan administration, because the hope and change thing is just too vague for, I think, where the electorate is right now.
Well, as you've indicated, they're also going to have to mobilize the base. But what about the undecided voters? How are they going to, do you have any gleaning as to how they're going to bring them in?
Well, you know, I know that both campaigns have developed extremely sophisticated ways, almost scientific ways, I would say, of reaching, identifying and reaching out to the voters who are undecided and trying to persuade them to come out for their candidate. On the other hand, we're also going to be hammered in the next 60 days by political advertising, the likes of which you have probably never seen because of all these outside groups who are so well-funded, I mean, unlimited funds. So they're going to be hammering from the top. They're going to be reaching out through more subtle means of demographic information. But one thing is, by Election Day, people are going to be exhausted.
I also noticed, in addition to Charlie Crist giving his endorsement for
yes.
President Obama, former governor of Florida, who was a Republican, they've got some employees from companies that were affected by Bain Capital giving speeches.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know about them so much, but I think anybody from Bain that the Republicans might think they might be able to capitalize on, they must also be aware that Elizabeth Warren is going to be one of the primary speakers on Wednesday. And, of course, she is the Harvard Law professor and the consumer watchdog who's running for Senate in Massachusetts, who's extremely popular with the Democratic base, but not very popular on Wall Street because of her advocating reforms on Wall Street. So, you know, for every Bain person, there is this extraordinary consumer advocate to kind of counteract any narrative on that front.
And what do you expect from the First Lady speech this evening?
You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see what she has to say. What we saw with Ann Romney in Tampa was a naked appeal to women, to the point of even shouting out Oprah-like at one point, "I love you women." You know, Michelle Obama is a person who has really carved out a very interesting kind of first ladyship for herself. She is very much on the soft side of things. She doesn't talk to political reporters. She goes on shows like Ellen DeGeneres and does, you know, push-up contests with her. She's on cooking shows. She's devoted herself to the fight against childhood obesity. I think she's just going to talk about her husband and what they've done. And, you know, she has the unique ability, because she is so popular, she is more popular than her husband, to reach out to people in a warm, emotional way. And I think we'll be seeing that, because that's what she's done as First Lady. I think the speech tonight is going to be an extension of that.
Robin Upkarian, again with us from Charlotte, North Carolina, national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Robin, thanks so much for joining
us. My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. And we're now joined by John Perez, who is Speaker of the California State Assembly, who will be speaking at the convention. He's also joining us from Charlotte. And welcome, Assembly Speaker.
Thank you very much, Michael. Great to be with you.
Good to have you with us. What's at stake for California in this election? We kind of do our own progressive thing anyway, don't we?
No. Let's be clear. The success of California is also dependent on the outcome of this election. It's important that we do everything we can to get President Obama reelected, but also to make sure that he has a Congress that's willing to work with him. We've noticed over the last several years with President Obama in the White House, California's return on investment, the amount of federal tax money that comes back and investment in our infrastructure and education and the like, has increased. But it was better still when we had a combination of a White House and a Congress that was willing to work together for California.
And what about the sense of pension reform, particularly since it's so big in California now? You had Chris Christie taking on public employee unions, and it seemed to resonate, as did Governor Walker in Wisconsin. California just completed the reform, and the unions weren't even at the table. Democrats relying too much on labor unions seems in decline.
No, let's be very clear about two things. One is that the Republican Party has been very effective at using different scapegoats at different points in time to advance their message. And so this year, the scapegoat of choice is unions. The reality for us in California is we have to be thoughtful about the policy changes that we make, and we moved forward aggressively on historic pension reform because it was the right policy outcome, not motivated out of hatred or divisiveness the way we saw with Walker or with Chris Christie.
We're also looking at a kind of frustration among many Latinos that the president hasn't done enough to help push reform on immigration. You think he's done enough?
Well, first of all, I think that you mischaracterize the level of frustration. People are frustrated by the lack of success, not by the lack of effort. This president has been very good in his effort to look for comprehensive immigration reform. The reality is that there are enough Republicans, even in the Senate, to filibuster any attempt to make meaningful reform. You saw the president's early efforts get thwarted by a few senators in particular, senators who had previously said they were willing to work on a bipartisan basis for pension reform. And this is an example of what we've seen over the last few years, that part of the Republican strategy is to use obstructionism to frustrate people, and that's what they've done on immigration as they have on other issues. But the president has been absolutely committed to immigration reform, and when the Congress was unwilling to go along with him, he figured out that which was in his power to act as an executive. You saw that expressed through what he did on the deferral program for young people, something that we're building on the strength of here in California.
We're talking with California State Assembly Speaker John Perez, who will be speaking at the convention. You want to get what message across in your speech, Speaker Perez?
Well, Michael, I'm going to be talking thematically about opportunity and the important role that opportunity has played in the fundamental advances we've had as a country and what the promise of renewed opportunity for Americans brings in a second Obama term.
And what about the fact, I'd asked Robin Apkarian, who we had on earlier, national correspondent for the LA Times, about the choice of North Carolina, a right-to-work state and a state that is opposed to same-sex marriage, which is on the Democratic platform?
Well, let's be clear. After North Carolina passed Amendment 1 expressing their opposition to same-sex marriage, there were some who said we need to boycott North Carolina not being the convention here. As Californians, that would be a really hypocritical thing for us because in 2000, we hosted the convention just after we had passed Prop 22, which was one of the early efforts to thwart the efforts for marriage equality. We bring the convention here because it's a swing state. Just like 4 years ago, we were in Colorado, which was a swing state. We have to go and take our message to every part of this country and hope to bring them along with us to a more progressive, inclusive view of the America we know we all deserve.
And how do we convince the American people, that is, we being you, the Democrats, that with a worsening recession and 8.3% economy, that we're better off than we were 4 years ago?
Well, first of all, Michael, on the we, we're happy to have you as part of the we.
Well, that came out in the wrong. I was speaking in the first person regal sense, of course.
Yes, I know. I just had to have a little fun with you. The reality is that this is the worst economic crisis on a global level. This is not a crisis of our making, but the solutions are of our making. And when you look at the way that the president has responded to the economic crisis, the investment to make sure that we save the American auto industry, and now GM is the number one automaker in the world again. The fact that he's really invested in tax equity for middle-class families, saying that we'll keep the lower tax rates for middle-class families but expect the people who do the best to pay their fair share, very important. The investment in infrastructure across the country, knowing that we have to build our way out of the crisis, not just cut our way out. There was a great piece in the New York Times a few weeks ago that said, in the modern world, no major economy has worked its way out of an economic crisis through austerity alone. It's a combination of smart austerity and smart investment, and that's exactly what we've seen with the Obama administration. We've had tens of months of continued job growth, which were in stark contrast to the period immediately preceding his presidency. And in California, we're growing jobs at a faster rate than the rest of the country because we've been thoughtful of how we do about how we make those cuts and how we make those investments.
Speaking of California, Speaker Perez, do we know why Governor Brown is not going to be at the convention? I know his father-in-law passed away last week, but
that was the issue that kept him away. His father-in-law passed away. We're hoping to have him join us later in the week, but obviously family comes first, and he needs to be with his wife and her family and dealing with his loss.
And one more question, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your response to Democratic Party Chair John Burton's remarks comparing Paul Ryan to Joseph Goebbels, which he has apologized for, but nevertheless caused quite a kerfuffle.
It did cause a kerfuffle. I think it is a way of expressing the comparison that he wishes he hadn't used. What he was trying to do was elucidate the fact that at the convention in Tampa, the Republicans were repeating certain mythologies that just don't have any basis in fact. And he was trying to express that if you tell the same lie over and over again, that doesn't make it the truth. And so I think the important question is what the underlying facts were, not John Burton's unfortunate choice of words and ways to express that.
Speaker Perez, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your being with
us. Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
John Perez, Speaker of the California State Assembly, who will be speaking at the convention. Our focus is on the Democratic National Convention. And by the way, if you'd like to join us with your thoughts about the convention, which is taking place today through Thursday in Charlotte, North Carolina, we certainly welcome your contributions to the conversation. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's available to you whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. And you can join us toll-free. 866-733-6786 is the number to join us. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or by going to our Facebook page. We're going to bring Chris Lehane into this conversation, and he's going to spend the rest of the hour with us, Democratic consultant and a partner in Fabiani and Lehane. Also spent 6 years in the Clinton White House, Vice President Al Gore's press secretary throughout the 2000 campaign, and he's with us again from Charlotte, North Carolina. Chris, welcome.
Michael, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Well, what makes this convention different in your judgment from the other conventions, which often are seen by the American people as, well, a lot of PR and hoopla?
Well, I guess I'd bifurcate it into two areas. You know, first of all, there is the question of the relevancy of conventions in the modern era, but I'm sure we'll get to that. You know, I do think that there are some real specific strategic objectives that the president is really looking to accomplish over the next 3 days. You know, I think the first, and you touched on this earlier, but, you know, meeting the burden of proof in terms of are we better off than we are 4 years ago. And I think, you know, Joe Biden has given everyone the bumper sticker slogan, right, which is that Bin Laden is dead and GM is alive. I think secondly, and it'd be very interesting to watch this over the next couple of days, is the president and his team and the various speakers, all of whom are very talented, able to inject excitement and energy, you know, into the Democratic base? You know, there's a so-called enthusiasm gap that exists. That typically exists with the party that's out of power vis-a-vis the party that's in power. But I do think that there's a real opportunity over the next 3 or 4 days to get people excited about what the next 4 years will look like. We live in an incredibly dynamic world. I think the president is more than capable of giving a compelling vision of what the next 4 years will look like. But I think both of these things, both the meeting the burden of proof on the question of are you better off than you were 4 years ago and giving people a sense of where the country is going, what his vision will be, I think ultimately go to the real issue he needs to drive home, which is the public trust question. He's winning in this election right now because people like him, and I think that's ultimately a derivative of the fact that they trust him, and they certainly trust him. He's met and he's demonstrated over the last 4 years he has what it takes to be president. But vis-a-vis Mitt Romney, I think the issue is going to come down to who do you trust more to make decisions that are going to impact you and your family, particularly on economic issues. And the Obama campaign gets up every single day, every single morning, and they know that that's what this campaign is going to rise and fall on, and they drive that message. And I think you're going to see that ultimately being the meta-narrative that comes out of the next 3 days.
Well, I'm wondering, actually, since you mentioned the enthusiasm gap and the fact that there's been almost a concession that hope and change isn't necessarily going to galvanize the way it did in the last elections. There's going to have to be a different tack taken by the Obama people in this election and with this campaign and in this convention. How much can you mobilize the base by saying essentially, well, you know, Mitt Romney's going backwards, he's a right winger, he's not going to help the middle class, vouchers for the old, privatizing Social Security. In other words, looking at the negative side of Romney Ryan as opposed to the positive side of what's up ahead, as you say, that might be outlined by President Obama in terms of the future of his presidency.
Right. It's a great question, and I really think that that gets to the heart of the next 3 days, which is, you know, thus far in the campaign, I think the Obama team and the president have done a very effective job with the negative, which is raising basic questions of trust about Romney. I do think that, you know, ultimately this campaign is a compound sentence, right? The first part is why you should be scared of what a Romney presidency would represent. The second part of that is really giving people some idea of where you're going to ultimately take the country over the next 4 years. And I think you're going to see that take part, I think, in chapters each day this week. I think with tonight, with Michelle Obama, the first lady, talking, she'll talk in personal terms about how she has seen her husband go about the job, what he cares about, what drives him, his character. I think the next day you'll see, you know, my old boss, Bill Clinton, set up the discussion on the economy in ways that Bill Clinton is uniquely positioned to do. And if I could use a sports analogy, I think, you know, effectively throw an alley-oop pass to the president to really bring it home on Thursday.
Alley-oop or Hail Mary?
Well, given where we are in this election, I think it's more of an alley-oop than a Hail Mary. But I do think set it up so that the president can then, you know, really reinforce and pound home what his vision is going to be. I think we as Democrats have a pretty good idea of why we should be scared of Mitt Romney. I think negative campaigns, despite, you know, everyone complaining and not liking them, they do work. They're extremely effective. But ultimately, you're a sitting president. You've had 4 years. You can certainly meet the burden that objectively we are better off than we were 4 years ago. This president came into office with enormous challenges, two wars, an economy going off the cliff. And you look at where we are today, he saved the economy from going off the cliff. We're out of Iraq, winding down in Afghanistan. He has a good story to tell, but ultimately people do want to know, where are we going? And we do live in an incredibly dynamic world where there's huge challenges facing our country. And this is a president who is enormously capable of talking with a sense of vision and where he's taking the country. And I think, you know, in 2008, and you touched on this earlier, but that was an aspirational campaign. And I think Robin made a very good point that Barack Obama, when running in 2008, was very much of a Rorschach candidate. And he's talked about this himself, right? He ran a campaign where people could project out to him what they wanted. Well, you've been president for 4 years. You've made a series of decisions. You know, you can't run an aspirational campaign.
Well, many of those people have been sorely disappointed, Chris, as I'm sure you'll concede, because the expectations were too high and too inflated.
Yeah, and I think that look at the expectations were so high, given the challenges that he was facing, that I think they'd have been, you know, virtually impossible for anyone to meet. That said, he himself, you know, has written. He did this the other day, in I think the ABC News interview. But he's talked about the fact that sometimes he has not been as good at communicating the day-to-day good job that he does as president. I think that this speech on Thursday does give him an opportunity to talk about what he's done for the last 4 years from a thematic perspective and tie it into the next 4 years.
Well, we're coming up on a hard break, and I want to again invite those of you listening to join us. What are your expectations for the Democratic National Convention? What would you like to see? And, well, maybe even what bothers you about it? Feel free to join us with your thoughts and your feelings. Toll free, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus is on the Democratic National Convention. Now that the Republican National Convention has wrapped up, all eyes are turning to Charlotte, North Carolina, where the convention officially kicks off today, and former President Clinton will be giving the nominating address to President Obama on the last night of the convention. We spoke earlier with Robin Abkarian, national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, who joined us from Charlotte, and Speaker John Perez of the California State Assembly, who also joined us from Charlotte. And we have Chris Lehane on with us, Democratic consultant and a partner to Fabiani and Lehane, who spent 6 years in the Clinton White House and was Vice President Al Gore's press secretary throughout the 2000 campaign. Congresswoman Barbara Lee represents California's 9th District, which includes Oakland. She will participate at the convention in revealing the party's platform, and she joins us this morning. And Congresswoman, welcome.
Thank you. Very happy to be with you today.
And glad to have you with us. Well, give us a little preview of perhaps what's being revealed on the party platform that maybe listeners don't know about. A lot of emphasis has been made on the position on choice and on the position on same-sex marriage. What else needs to be seen at this point?
Sure. The platform will be released tonight, but just the basic elements of it are important to recognize in terms of the general principles. First, any party platform, especially our platform, sets forth really, it's a statement of values. It's a statement of what, first of all, the president has accomplished, such as passing the, the Recovery Act, which saved over a million jobs. So it sort of lists what the accomplishments have been, but also what more we need to do and what the vision is for the future. It's a platform that really speaks to the TARE tax fairness issue as it relates to ensuring that millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share and that the brunt of our tax system is not placed on the middle class and those aspiring to the middle class. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, so many people, as a result of the previous administration's economic policies, have fallen from the middle class and are struggling day by day just to make ends meet. And so we have to, and our party platform speaks to those in the middle class and those who have fallen from or who are aspiring for the middle class. It also is a contrast. The platform really distinguishes the Democrats and the Democratic platform and the president from the Republican platform in the sense that it really sets forth, for example, as it relates to women's health care decisions, that women should have a right to their own health care decisions, whereas the contrast in the Republican platform really is just the opposite, which, I mean, even their platform bans abortion, even in the cases of rape or incest. And so I think our platform sets forth not only what the Democratic Party believes, but it's a platform for all Americans to embrace because it really speaks to reigniting the American dream for all.
And you envision a unified party behind this platform? Certainly the Democratic Party in the past has had a lot of special divisions in terms of interests and the like.
I was on the drafting committee. There were 15 of us on the drafting committee for the platform. And I have to tell you, this was an open process. We heard stories and took testimony from many, many people, many organizations. For example, we heard from several people whose jobs were saved as a result of the president's actions with regard to the auto industry. And so it was an open process, which includes the ideas of many, many people, but also it's a vision, that the president has and that the Democrats have for the future of America and for those who deserve to live the American dream. And so we came to agreement on this platform, and, you know, there's some new elements of it which will be revealed tonight, but I'm very proud of those new components of the platform because it makes it a more just and a fair platform, and it really demonstrates the choice between the two candidates and our two parties.
We're talking with Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina. And Congresswoman, let me ask you specifically, since you've been a strong critic and sometimes a lone voice against the wars, particularly the Iraq War, but there's been criticism of the Republican convention in that Governor Romney made no mention of the war. What would you like to hear from President Obama, particularly since he's getting a lot of flack for giving out timetables from the Republicans and even others who feel that that was wrongheaded of him? Congresswoman Lee, do we have you? I think it's an important question. I hope we can get back to her and make connection with her. Let me go to some calls here. Chris Lehane is going to be with us, and we'd like you, our listeners, to chime in and weigh in. And let's begin, Jay, with you. Good morning.
Thanks. Just quickly, regarding the "Are you better off now than 4 years ago?" question, first, I'd like to hear the president make a strong case that we are, for the simple reason that the arterial bleeding of the patient has stopped and the patient is stabilized and slowly getting healthier. And if you think about FDR's reelection in after the last economic disaster that was years in the making, in 1936, he was reelected. you could have. We were in the depths of the Depression, and he was reelected anyway. So you can make a case that if the people understand that you have a plan and what's going and what your vision is going forward, you can get reelected even if the economy is not better off.
All right, Jay, I appreciate your input on that, and I think we have Congresswoman Lee back on the line here. We hope it's a good line. Congresswoman, are you with us?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Yeah. Back to that question I'm asking, what would you like to hear, particularly in light of the criticism of the timetables that President Obama's given out, and particularly you're being so critical of the war efforts both in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Sure, and thank you. And, of course, I did not support either one, and I believe that thank goodness, you know, we've ended the war in Iraq. It took much, much, much too long. We should have never gone in there. There were no weapons of mass destruction. So I'm glad that President Obama, you know, ended that war. And I think that we need to, of course, I believe we need to expedite the drawdown in troops in Afghanistan and end the war in Afghanistan. The American people are war weary. They're tired of our resources, trillions of dollars going abroad to Afghanistan. Of course, we have some responsibility to help in rebuilding the country, but not in a military presence. A long-term military presence will not bode our national security well. There's no military solution in Afghanistan, and we need to get out of Afghanistan, bring our young men and women home, and provide for their economic security and their health care and their mental health care. And so that's what I want to hear, and that's what I want to see. And I know, you know, the president does have a timetable. Some of us believe that the timetable, of course, should be expedited. But there is a timetable, and we have to, you know, move forward and bring our troops home.
Could you just quickly respond, Congresswoman, to a listener's remark about President Obama's leadership? This is Maureen who writes, my problem is with President Obama's lack of leadership. He does not fight but gets tied up in compromises. He switches rather than fights. He is certainly no great leader and is more interested in making deals. I think President Obama has to assert himself as a leader in this convention, doesn't he? How does he do that?
Well, I think he has. And when you look at the fact, first of all, that we have an obstructionist Tea Party Congress, we have over 70 members of the Tea Party. We have a Senate head, you know, Senator Mitch McConnell indicated early on that their first priority was to make sure President Obama was a one-term president. And so you have to understand that everything the president fights for has been stopped by the Tea Party. And so it's very important that not only we reelect President Obama, but that we take back the House and ensure that many of us believe is who is the greatest speaker ever, Nancy Pelosi, that she is reelected as speaker. That's how we move forward, because the president has been fighting with the Republicans and trying to work with them. I mean, he indicated early on that he wanted to work in the spirit of bipartisanship. He tried that. That did not work. I think you remember the debt ceiling deal, all of the efforts that he put forth to try to bring some consensus, because the country does not want to see partisan bickering and bipartisan and fighting amongst Democrats and Republicans. But the president, you know, realizes that he has to move forward, that he has to have a House and a Senate that's going to move forward with him.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, we thank you so much for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thank you.
Congresswoman Lee joined us from Charlotte, North Carolina, represents California's 9th District, which includes Oakland. And we're going to continue with Chris Lehane, who's with us also from Charlotte, North Carolina, Democratic consultant and partner at Fabiani and Lehane. And we go to more of your calls. We go to Pontiac, Michigan. Welcome, Don. You're on.
Welcome. I'm so glad you guys are having this talk. I'm definitely looking forward to this convention. And it was interesting over the weekend on C-SPAN, they played Harry Truman's acceptance speech from 1948, and I saw a great deal of parallels where the Republican Congress stood in his way and wouldn't enact what he was trying to do for the 4 years, and then put those planks in their platform and said, this is what we're going to do. From day one, since President Obama has been elected, that's been the Republican goal, is to stand in his way and make sure that he's only one term. And I think somebody needs to take away their argument that he hasn't done anything. Are you better off? Well, he hasn't done anything. He's tried, but this Republican Congress has stood in his way, and they should bear the brunt of, this is why things haven't been done.
Well, Don, I thank you for those comments, and they dovetail with, and let's get Chris LaHange's response to this, a listener named Bradley who sends in the following email. He says, something that seems to have been missing from the lead-up to the election has been Congress's role in the last 4 years. I'm struck by President Obama's unwillingness to directly speak out against the dogmatic Republican congressional resistance to each and every step that he has attempted to make, and in some ways this fits his wish to avoid partisan politics. That said, sooner or later everyone has their limits. What are the chances that Obama is going to take a more directly aggressive posture, calling out the Republican strategy of obstructionism? I would intuit that we might get a lot more of this at this convention, Chris LaHange, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think it's a safe bet that you'll certainly have, you know, significant elements of that. And, you know, the earlier caller referenced Harry Truman and the Do Nothing Congress, where President Truman really laid the blame at the feet of the Republicans. But what he also did was give the country, you know, a specific sense of where he wanted to take the country at that time. And obviously it was a very different time period than today, but he also had some very specific planks. And so he really called the question, forced the question, and imposed his will on the campaign. And I think that's some of the types of stuff that in this day and age that you're going to see coming from the president and from the Democratic Party over the next couple of days. It's not just going to solely be, hey, Republicans have been obstructionists. That has to be part of the narrative. It has to be part of the conversation. But then you need to take it to the next step. And here's where I think we need to go. Here's the challenges that we face. Here's how we're going to solve them. The Republicans can either participate or they can get out of the way, but they need to stop being obstructionists. You know, the president has touched on this at various times over the last year or so, that you know, maybe he hasn't done as good a job as he needed to do in terms of communicating what he was dealing with and where he really wanted to take the country. This is an opportunity to do that. In many respects, it's an opportunity to hit a little bit of a reset button in terms of where he wants to go and to really sort of frame up that discussion. And I think that's what you're going to see almost in chapter verse over the next several days.
What about that argument, though, that he hasn't been aggressive enough, that in the interest of being bipartisan or stepping across the aisle or amity or whatever you want to call it, he hasn't called out the Republicans nearly as much as he should have?
Well, I think that changed probably about 18 months ago. I do think that for the first 2 years of his administration, right, I mean, he ran in 2008 on seeking to be a post-partisan president, someone who is going to try to do things differently in Washington, D.C. And he made a real effort to do that. The problem was, as the congresswoman pointed out, the Republicans from day one had a mission, and that mission was to make him a one-term president. They said as much. And I think it took him a little bit of time for that to really break through and the reality to hammer home. You know, I think beginning really at the tail end of last summer, you saw a new president, one who became much more confrontational and much more direct in challenging the Republicans. I think you're going to see that in even greater clarity, particularly given, you know, where Romney stands on some specific issues, but really challenging the Republicans. Okay, here's where I stand. Here's what I want to do. You guys have stood in the way of progress. You guys have made decisions that have put politics ahead of what's in the best public policy interest of our country. But I think he needs to do it forcefully. But as I've said a couple times now, to effectively do that, you do need to offer the positive. You do need to say, this is what we've accomplished over the last 4 years. Here's what I want to do next that offers some continuity and some consistency in terms of the vision, and then make clear that the Republicans have stood in the way of progress.
Well, you may recall when Oprah Winfrey asked him to give himself a grade, I guess it was after about a year in office, on how he was doing. He said B+, and a lot of people were ticked and thought maybe another example of great inflation. But more recently, he was asked you know, to give himself a grade on how he sees the economy, and his response was incomplete. Let me get another caller on here for you. And this is Jake in Davis. Jake, join us. Hi.
Hi. 4 years ago, we talked a lot about Supreme Court nominations, and I was wondering why that hasn't come up this time. We've got Ruth Ginsburg, who has not only had cancer in the past and is also quite elderly, and then there's other elderly members of the court.
Well, it would seem to be, by most reckoning, Chris LaHange, or ought to be a major linchpin of any campaign for presidency.
You know, it's really an interesting issue, and it comes up every 4 years. And absent, you know, arguably the presidential election in 72 and to some extent in 76, you know, the Supreme Court argument never really manifests itself as a major campaign issue, even though obviously it is arguably one of the most long-lasting legacy-making decisions the president can make. I mean, the ability to shape or reshape a court will long outlive any 8-year term. It can go on for a generation and shape the country in so many ways. But I just think it ends up being one of those issues that doesn't seem immediate, doesn't necessarily seem tangible to the voters. You know, I can certainly tell you from someone who does campaigns and who looks at a lot of polling data, it's just not one of the issues that sort of rises to the level of generating enormous voter interest. And so what you typically have is you'll maybe have each candidate do their speech on their how they'd approach the court. You will typically get a question in the debates on it. You know, the papers will do their one story on it, but it never becomes, you know, a central issue in a campaign. But as I've said, it ends up being one of those decisions and one of those areas that, you know, is one of the single most impactful decisions that the president will make, and it goes on long after they've been in office.
Well, I think Ricardo was on the line to bring up some similar concern about environmental issues on the platform. Ricardo, go ahead. You're on.
Good morning, Michael, and to your guests there. I'm calling in regards just to an environmental platform that I haven't heard much on, and I would just preface this first with the loss of 38,000 plus square miles a day of Arctic recession right now in the ice sheet. And it's on the Tuesday, August 28th Chronicle. So you can check that out for yourself. I'd like to see if Richard Muller, I think you interviewed him, physicist from Berkeley, a week and a half ago or so.
He was on with Dave Iverson, but I've known Richard for many years. And
yeah, it's incredible that was one of the talking heads points that the Republicans used against the global warming processes. And I would hope that he would be able to be invited so you could skewer the Republicans, because Romney said that President Obama wants to see less ocean rise, and he wants to save the planet while he wants to save jobs. You can't save jobs if your planet is underwater. So I would like to also see James Hansen invited from NASA, the climatologist that the Bush administration skewered for 8 years plus with all the wonderful work he did at NASA in Florida.
Now, we've also had Jim Hansen on forum as well. In fact, maybe we'll be doing more about covering these issues. But what and having some of the folks on that he listed here, what about the fact that we're not hearing that much about the environment either, though, Chris Lehane?
Well, first of all, the story about the ice cap that was in the papers a couple days ago was truly astounding, and I share the caller's concerns. I actually do think you're going to hear about this. In fact, there's a local tie-in on this, which is one of the speakers who's been tasked to talk about clean energy and the environment by the Obama White House is a San Franciscan, Tom Steyer. Yeah. Who runs a major hedge fund in San Francisco, but has also really become one of the countries, if not the global leaders, in addressing clean energy and climate change. And he's actually going to be giving a speech asked for by the president and the administration specifically on the subject of clean energy and climate change. I think when you see Democrats talking about it, they talk about it from the context of, okay, can we put in place, you know, a clean energy economy? Obviously, part of the predicate for a clean energy economy is the fact that we do have climate change taking place and we need to address it, and that it does present enormous economic opportunities for us as a country. And I think when you see Democrats addressing the issue, the climate change issue really does get tied up into the whole clean energy discussion. I think the president is going to talk about it in his address as well. I think at the core of the president's jobs program and his economic vision is clearly clean energy. Are these jobs going to be in the United States, or are those jobs going to be in China? Those jobs are coming. The real question is, are they here or there?
I'll read some comments from listeners who have put their comments on Facebook, which you, of course, are cordially invited to do. Mark writes on our Facebook page, Republicans are making the fallacious argument that government is innately bad. The plan, perhaps, is to lure Democrats into making the equally fallacious argument that government is innately good. Might a better, more persuasive, and ultimately more accurate argument be that government is a tool that in the hands of those willing and able to see its value can be employed to make people's lives better or worse, but only those who see its value could ever hope to use it to the public benefit. And Michael from San Francisco writes on our Facebook page, the fact that some made a big deal out of Ryan being likened to Goebbels is a tactic of the liar. Redirect, obfuscate the truth of the thing said, get the discussion onto something different. Please don't let it end there. Bring the discussion back to the fact that Ryan has been making accusations that do not hold up to scrutiny. What Goebbels said was that if you repeat a lie often enough, people believe it. We all know that this has been a tactic of the right for longer than anyone can remember. Well, what was your response to that, Chris Lehane? Let's forget about the fact that Paul Ryan also may have outright lied on his time in the marathon running department. But let's look at John Burton's comment about his. I mean, the Republicans came back and said they're using the Nazi thing. Well, you know, it's not necessarily a smart idea to. And John can be intemperate. To say someone is like Joseph Goebbels, who's in the public eye, but he never used the word Nazi, and he did apologize.
Yeah, you know, in D.C., the definition of a gaffe is unintentionally saying what you really believe. Right. Those of us who know John Burton knows he always intentionally says what he believes. I mean, look, John doesn't pull his punches. He obviously apologized, you know, particularly for using the Goebbels line. But, you know, people have used the line time and time again that if you continue to repeat a lie, it eventually becomes a truth. I mean, that is something that people do talk about. And, you know, if you actually get to the essence of what he was talking about, you had the vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party stand up in a major address before the country and put out pieces of information that he knows were not accurate or are not accurate. You know, in particular, you know, focusing on the plant, you know, in Wisconsin, that he asserted had closed under the president and that the president hadn't really engaged or addressed, you know, was a blatant fabrication. He knows full well that that plant was closed before Barack Obama was president.
It was closed under the George W. Bush administration, in fact.
That's exactly right. And you know, in terms of the Republican Party's, you know, discussion of the prior administration, it was almost as if George W. Bush had been put in the witness protection program. I mean, they barely referenced anything that took place. It was almost as if the world had begun, you know, in January of 2009. And so I do think ultimately what John was getting at, you know, was something that was worthy of discussion, which is just pointing out that, you know, you can't go out there on a major stage and issue something that is a blatant lie and not expect to get called on it.
Here's a listener who writes on our webpage, listener named Gail. I would like to see forward as the message of the convention. It is both accurate and memorable. And Will writes, I'm a longtime Dem voter, but I will not be voting for Obama for a second term. The Bush-era erosion of liberties and expansion of executive privilege was central to my concerns in 2008, but has been furthered and codified with Obama's signing of the NDAA 2012 bill and other actions. And Bonnie, sort of heralding back to the Supreme Court decision that goes with who the next president will be, writes, my number one concern in the November election is who will be president, when and if 1 to 4 Supreme Court justices will be replaced. There are 2 conservatives, Scalia and Kennedy, and 2 moderates, Ginsburg and Breyer, aged 74 to 76, on the court today. If even one moderate is replaced by 1 conservative, the balance will be firmly on the side of corporate and moneyed interests. Roe versus Wade will also be at risk, since Romney was quoted by The Economist as saying that if elected, he would nominate anti-abortion justices. And Lynn writes, I don't know, maybe, Chris, you can cast some light on this. Please discuss comments that Republicans made that they, quote, want a first lady who looks like a first lady. I'm not aware what this is alluding to. Do you know?
No, I'm not sure either. There's a lot of stuff out there in the blogosphere, so it's potentially that someone may have read something out there, but I'm not aware of anything formally done in that vein.
But we've got more callers who want to join us. And Chris, you're next. Hi, join us.
My problem is that Wall Street bonuses are alive and UAW pensions and health care are dead. Where this president is taking us in the economic sphere is further to corporate domination. I mean, I'm going to vote for him because Romney's worse. But the idea that this president is a Democrat can only be said by somebody who doesn't understand any history. He's a nice, moderate Republican.
Well, what about that argument? It gets back to the whole question I asked Barbara Lee, Chris Lehane, about unity in the party. I mean, there are a lot of Democrats who think Obama's too tied to Wall Street. He's getting as much money, roughly, as Romney is from Wall Street, or close to it. And the fact is that there are plenty of Democrats who would like to see him go after Wall Street. And then there are the moderate sort of conservative Democrats who think just fine to, as the left might see it, be in bed with Wall Street.
Yeah, you know, I think this ultimately comes back to the fact that in 2008, you know, this is a president who ran, and we've touched on this, as an aspirational figure. And so at that time, if you were on the left, you thought you were going to get the great left hope. If you were a centrist, you thought you were getting a centrist. And once he became president, he did not necessarily replace the aspirational aspect of his profile with a really specific vision of where he was going. I do think that day in and day out, he makes really good decisions. But by definition, every day as president, you're making hundreds and hundreds of decisions. There's going to be winners and losers. Some people are going to be happy. Some people are going to be less happy with each of those decisions. And as someone who is aspirational, that's particularly problematic if you don't replace that aspiration with a sort of broader, transcendent idea of where you're taking the country so people can understand how this all fits together. And I do think that has been one of his challenges. He himself has talked about the fact that he has not given the story. He has not provided the narrative of what the last 4 years has been about. I do think that, you know, if there is a lesson to be learned from, you know, from a presidential leadership perspective, and he's obviously an exceptionally smart guy and obviously gets this, it is how do you actually use the bully pulpit of the presidency to tell a story, to create a narrative, to create a framing out there so that everyone understands that you're making these decisions not in a vacuum, but because you have a larger sense of where you're trying to take the country. I would say to, you know, to the caller's point about the UAWs versus, you know, versus the quote-unquote corporatization, I too feel the pain that he expressed. You know, we're 4 years into this, right? And you've got various folks who are focused on attacking organized labor and people's pensions, you know, 3.5 years after we had bailed out the banks. And so why is it that the working folks are ultimately being held accountable and responsible when, you know, the banks really haven't been? So I certainly feel that pain.
Well, we will continue to follow what's going on in Charlotte. We thank Chris Lehane. Thank you, Chris, for being with us this whole hour, Democratic consultant and partner at Fabiani and Lehane and Vice President Gore's press secretary through 2000 campaign. We will also invite you to continue your comments, lots of them coming in, on what your expectations are for the Democratic National Convention by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment, or our Facebook page, or simply go to our Twitter, which is at KQED Forum. I want to remind you that Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Amanda Stupai, and Tina Larberg. Irene Noguchi, our senior editor, is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.